This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
Welcome back. Our subscriber base dropped by like 99% when you were out, but you're back. So what are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, there's no way that's true. I really enjoyed listening to that episode, actually, not knowing what was in there. And I think your guest co-star was just wonderful.
Okay, so 98% reduction.
No, I'm sure if anything, the count probably grew. But I am back now. Just in case anyone was wondering or worried, I just had a little non-OBGYN issue come up unexpectedly. It involved an ER visit, but not worth boring people about the details, but I am back in podcasting shape now.
People don't realize we work out to be able to sound this good.
Yeah, this is very physically taxing. But anyway, I thought it could be neat to talk about 10 things that we wish ER doctors and other non-OBGYNs knew about OBGYN. And we also, of course, have a couple of news events to address.
Well, before we do that, I will say, just as a preface, we're not picking on ER docs at all. I think that, I don't mean it to come across that way, you had a great experience at the ER. If you go there with a real problem, I think they're obviously they're life-saving and an important part. But people use them for problems that maybe they shouldn't go there for. And then you catch them sometimes outside of their domain. It's not their expertise. They're not OBGYNs, for example. And if you don't have a real emergency, then maybe you shouldn't go. If you've got an ectopic pregnancy or you've got some life-threatening condition or a real emergency, then they're going to be your best friend in the world. But I do think that it's utilized for less urgent issues that get outside of their area of expertise.
Yeah. And then we see the follow-ups of that and have to kind of
chuckle.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that's what we'll kind of what we'll talk about today. But first, what's a thing we do for no reason?
Well, how about getting urine cultures every trimester for patients who have sickle cell trait?
Yes. We have talked about this before, not on the podcast, but just between us. I don't think that maybe you see this as much as I do, but I see a lot of providers ordering a urine or recommending to order a urine culture with every trimester routinely for patients who have sickle cell trait.
Not disease, just the trait itself.
Right, just the trait, just one of the genes mutated.
Yeah, I hadn't heard this one as much, but I did find a lot of stuff about this. And so in the past, it's been believed that pregnant women who have sickle cell trait have higher rates of asymptomatic bacteria and acute cystitis, and therefore, or perhaps not therefore, pyelonephritis than other pregnant women. This is true for people with sickle cell disease, meaning that people who have two abnormal hemoglobin beta genes rather than just one, actual carriers of the disease. But people with just the trait, who have just one abnormal gene, although they do have slightly lower blood counts and they are affected somewhat, they don't seem to be as affected, obviously, overall by sickle cell disease or by these urinary tract issues. So pyelonephritis can be very significant to a pregnant woman. In fact, it can even be fatal. And even just asymptomatic bacteria can also lead to things like preterm birth. We think 5% of preterm birth is related to asymptomatic bacteria. So I think in the past, folks just developed the idea that women with sickle cell trait should also get more screening for asymptomatic bacteria, just like a sickle cell disease patient might, and that this would help prevent some of those issues. But there's a couple of false assumptions here, and it's not an evidence-based approach. So back in the 1960s, Jack Pritchard, along with a physician colleague of his named Peggy Whaley, it might be Whaley, it's got two L's, I'm not sure, at Parkland in Texas, they published an article in JAMA that looked at sickle cell trait and urinary tract infections during pregnancy. This was in 1964. And they actually found that only one woman of the 409 women they studied who had sickle cell trait went on to develop pyelonephritis after having a negative first trimester urine culture. And this was actually in agreement with, they were expounding upon a previous study done by Dr. Cass in 1962. So these findings were essentially replicated and published again in the Green Journal in 2005, and I'll put a link to that as well. This was done by Dr. Soper at MUSC, and they found that women with sickle cell trait actually have a similar prevalence of asymptomatic bacteria and acute cystitis as matched control patients who didn't have the sickle mutation. And they also found that the pathogens that those patients were susceptible to were the same pathogens in both groups. And they also found, most importantly, that increased testing did not decrease the incidence of subsequent pyelonephritis. So it seems that these approaches to extra cultures or screening have developed organically over the years. it does appear to be true that there's increased rates of pyelonephritis, even though the rates of acute cystitis or asymptomatic bacteria are not increased. But the extra urine cultures every trimester don't make a difference in the risk of developing pyelonephritis.
So maybe since they do have that increased risk of pyelo, even though screening for it more frequently won't reduce that risk, maybe if a woman with sickle cell trait has had a UTI even once during pregnancy, then maybe it would be reasonable to just prophylax her for the rest of her pregnancy instead of waiting for her to get pyelo or waiting for her to get a second UTI like maybe we otherwise would do.
Yeah, that seems like it would be a reasonable approach in patients like this. And I think Dr. Soper's paper seemed to advocate for that. That paper's 18 years old. But yeah, that would be a reasonable idea.
Okay, well, let's move on and talk about a few things that we tend to see quite frequently from patients who have been to either walk-in clinics or emergency departments or sometimes their primary care providers. These are things that sometimes can frustrate us due to what seems like a lack of understanding or maybe just misperceptions of the things we deal with as OBGYNs. And I agree that this is not meant to criticize in any way. I think that ER doctors deal with so much, such a wide breadth of things, and including a lot of things that they really shouldn't have to deal with. And so some of this frustration may be on us not understanding what they deal with, or maybe not being clear or collegial enough towards them when they do call us to ask for follow-up recommendations and stuff. Because overall, I think we can work really well together with other specialties and be really cohesive if we just communicate well with each other and maybe even maintain some basic understanding of each other's specialties, evidence-based guidelines and standards of care. So hopefully this all just comes across as constructive and maybe even an invitation to tell us your side from the non-OB side.
Yeah, sure. A huge part of our practice as generalist OBGYNs involves either acute emergency department consultations or at least calls for questions or outpatient follow-ups with some less acute visits or urgent care or even primary care visits. And unfortunately, we often tend to roll our eyes a bit at what happened when we see those patients in follow-up and hear what the ER physician might have told the patient was wrong with them or what their impression was. And some of that's the telephone game too. Patients distort what they were told. They don't really understand, et cetera. But I also think that you should work at developing a relationship with your ER docs where they're very, very comfortable calling, even for that quick curbside. And don't feel bad about saying, hey, you know, the quant, I probably wouldn't have ordered it there because of X, Y, and Z, or whatever the case might be. And they'll learn from that if you're collegial. There are, though, too, some structural problems, I think, in the way ER medicine is practiced that tends to have a triage nurse see patients up front, maybe order a large panel of tests or in some cases even imaging before a history and physical is really taken. That part is more fundamental and is something that has to really change about ER to fix some of these issues. But yeah, this isn't a criticism, or it's not meant to be.
Yeah. And usually those really acute calls where they actually want us to come see the patient are more straightforward. Like if something is clearly wrong with the patient, maybe even acutely life-threatening, we come in, maybe do whatever intervention or recommendation before the visit's even over and it's all kind of settled. But it's really these subacute ones where they don't necessarily need to call us. And then they do what they can and send the patient out. And there's a lapse of time between whatever happened at that visit and then us getting involved. So starting off with number one is ovarian cysts. So these do occur physiologically. Cysts do not mean that something is wrong and something has to be removed. Actually, ovulating women get cysts every month. So it's normal to have a cyst. And these cysts rarely cause pain, at least when they're smaller. But if a woman goes in with pelvic or abdominal pain and she gets imaging, like a CT or an ultrasound, and that radiologist happens to discover any kind of ovarian cyst, even under 3.5 centimeters, then that ER provider might tell her, well, maybe that's why you're in pain, especially if they haven't already found some other obvious answer. And then they say, follow up with your gynecologist. So I think there just needs to be more discrimination between different types of cysts. Some are bad, but most of them are not bad and are actually normal. So the worry is if they anchor their diagnosis of pain from cyst on this tiny cyst that they happen to see because they got imaging, they may not give other differential diagnoses their fair consideration.
Yeah, I think there's a cognitive pattern here that you've described that we'll see for a lot of these 10 issues. So cognitively, the ER provider has premature closure, which is a cognitive bias. they are overly reliant on the CT scan or the ultrasound, or in other cases, upon labs. And the radiologist will report things, including that she has a cyst, and that cyst is important or relevant, or that it causes pain or anything like that, but it'll be down there in the bottom in the conclusion, and someone will read it. And as you said, these cysts are often just corpus luteal cysts or follicles, 3-centimeter follicles, things like that. If you took women who are not on suppressive systemic birth control and just scanned them all randomly, you'd find cysts about half the time. But those women aren't running to the emergency department with pelvic and abdominal pain due to these smaller sub-3.5-centimeter physiologic cysts. So the ovarian cyst sometimes becomes the, well, your scan's normal, I don't know why you're hurting, here was a positive thing on imaging, and is just a bit of a whipping boy. Then the patient comes and sees us and was told to follow up and still has no answer about her pain. And it's up to the gynecologist maybe to re-explore the differential diagnosis and work through that with her.
Yeah, this phenomenon, this happens a lot, probably to all of us. It does force OBGYNs to get more familiar with pain syndromes related to other organ systems, especially GI, or maybe neurologic conditions like fibromyalgia. But ultimately, we're still most familiar with the female reproductive system. And if someone is sent to us with unexplained pelvic pain, and they, even if they only have a physiologic cyst, they may ultimately be on a fast track towards getting a diagnostic laparoscopy because they were sent to the GYN, even though that might not have been necessary at all.
Yeah, I'm happy to turn those guns inward too, that a ton of laparoscopies for young women with cysts under, let's say, 5 centimeters are completely unnecessary and exploitative. Yeah. But you're right, the sort of triage cue that this is an ER patient and the ER whatever, it leads to this sort of bias pathway that leads to unnecessary surgery. So I would be more critical of the gynecologists who are operating on these and the ER docs who sent them for follow-up.
Yeah, and obviously it's not that ovarian cysts are never the cause of pain, because there are plenty of examples of pathologic cysts that will invariably cause symptoms and do need some kind of intervention. But that mainly applies to larger cysts or ovarian torsion or maybe ruptured hemorrhagic cysts that are causing pain. And especially if we're talking about acute pain where they were fine and then suddenly they can tell you exactly what time of day it was when suddenly it began to hurt. And if it's an endometrioma on ultrasound, say, even if it's small, even if it's like 1 centimeter, it may be the explanation for chronic pain, but we're talking about acute pain that brings someone to the ER.
Yeah, and it's generally safe to say that any cyst, as we've mentioned a couple of times, under 3.5 centimeters is just never the source of the problem. You mentioned ovarian torsion. About 95% of torsions occur with cysts between 6 and 10 centimeters. They need to be large enough to have the weight to carry them to TORS and stay that way. And that ovarian pain is incredibly severe, but you need that larger underlying cyst in order to get the torsion in most cases. So under 3.5 centimeters, if they're simple appearing, they're not a problem, they don't need follow-up, etc. For a brief time at a hospital I used to work at, I was able to get the radiologist to agree to just not report cysts that were under simple cysts that were under 3.5 centimeters. And that made a big difference. They just didn't mention them. But that didn't last long. And clearly, when they mention them, it leads the ER provider, who may not know that much about ovarian cysts, to think that this could be a pathological problem or some issue. So old habits die hard.
Yeah, that's kind of a bummer. But because I bet every ER department eventually has enough turnover of their staff. Well, in this case, it's radiology, but still, that you teach one cadre of them, but then the next, you have to kind of keep teaching them. So.
Well, and there might be a reason why you want those cysts reported if you're doing reproductive endocrinology or something like that. And you're they do need to, that's why they do it. It's part of a standard exam. Yeah. It's there. It's just our job to know that's not pathological.
But they could go and even write in their impression like normal physiologic appearing cyst.
And many of them do. They'll say appears to be a follicular cyst, but there's always that hedge language in there where they don't want to say something that has a histologic diagnosis from a radiologic imaging.
Cannot rule out whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to number two, which is kind of a corollary to number one, and that is isolated free fluid in the pelvis. Because sometimes there won't be a cyst on CT, or maybe again, there'll be a small one, but the radiologist will also comment on some free fluid in the cul-de-sac. And that will be interpreted to mean that they used to have a cyst and then it ruptured before they got to the hospital. And therefore that must be why they have pain.
Yeah, this is equally frustrating, I think. So free fluid is, again, a normal physiologic finding for most reproductive age women. The key here is to distinguish between a little bit of free fluid in the cul-de-sac and hemiperitoneum, or massive, large amounts, massive hemiperitoneum or ascites or things like that. And it's not hard if the uterus and ovaries are kind of swimming in free fluid, or there's large amounts of clot present in the fluid, then that's a concern and something is probably bleeding and that can cause very significant symptoms. But a centimeter or less of free fluid in the cul-de-sac is just normal. It doesn't mean that she recently had a cyst rupture onto the emergency department and that's what caused her pain. But I hear that too often, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, you're going to love the next one. Number three is that UTIs, they're actually relatively uncommon, but just as ovarian cysts tend to be a go-to diagnosis for women who present with pelvic or abdominal pain, so too do urinary tract infections. But we know that in the ER, around 80 to 90% of women who are told they have a UTI and are treated empirically for that ultimately don't have one on culture. Many women go to the ER and then will leave with this diagnosis. And over time, they'll even believe that they get recurrent UTIs that are causing things like chronic back pain or, frankly, any other symptom that is unrelated to UTI.
Yeah, and this is related to the sort of systemic issue I talked about where ERs just tend to get a urine on every woman that comes in. I don't know if they do this for men, but on every woman. And part of it is I got to do a pregnancy test because I might image them. So they're getting the urine, they're sending it to the lab. And these things are being ordered ahead, in many cases, ahead of the provider seeing the patient and saying, gosh, I would like to see a urinalysis here. But a UA is not even a definitive test. It's not even really a test at all for urinary tract infection. In fact, urinary tract infections should be treated without any test whatsoever. If a woman has new onset burning and urgency and she has an uncomplicated history and she has classic symptoms, you're just supposed to treat her. It doesn't matter what the UA says. But often, if there's one parameter that sometimes is associated with a UTI, like leukocyte esterase or nitrates, then the physician will take that as definitive or definitive enough, I guess, for the moment to go ahead and treat them. I'll put a link to a recent article that looks at this practice, this systemic practice of routine urinalysis for patients who come to the emergency department and argues against it in the ER literature. In fact, a lot of the emergency medicine literature says that doctors need to stop doing this. But in this particular study, the result showed that about 85% of patients who were treated for UTIs didn't meet the clinical or diagnostic criteria or both for having a urinary tract infection. But again, there's that issue with premature diagnostic closure because you think, okay, I found it. She's got a UTI. That probably explains her back pain. It doesn't. And meanwhile, the real source of the problem isn't addressed.
I know we've talked about it before, and your book also uses urinary tract infections as an example of how to interpret a diagnostic test. But the presence of leukocyte esterase or even nitrates on a urinalysis in a patient who doesn't specifically have dysuria and urinary frequency mean almost nothing. It's almost certainly not going to be a UTI. Maybe I would make an exception if they're a complicated patient like prolonged catheterization or something like that.
Right. But then it depends on the pretest probability from the symptoms, right, or that complicated history. And that's the point of why the UAs are not very helpful, because it's the symptoms or the confounding presentation that is what makes it. So nitrites in your situation sitting there right now means nothing. And nitrites in somebody who's been peeing every 30 minutes for the last 3 days means the world.
Yeah. But it does seem like this is frequently the reason that a patient gets diagnosed with a UTI in an acute setting, even if they came in with totally unrelated complaints.
Yeah. Here's a crazy one for you. If ER docs are worried about their length for these patients, if a young reproductive age woman came in and said, I have had new onset urinary frequency and terminal dysuria when I pee, all you have to do is take out the prescription pad, write a prescription for Macrobidobacterium, and say, have a nice day. And that's it. You don't need any CBCs, BMPs, UAs, or anything else. But again, unfortunately, systematically, that patient has seen the triage nurse. She's gotten an IV started. She's gotten bloods drawn, a rainbow panel, a urinalysis, all this stuff already processed. And that takes 6 hours to get results back and do all that. And I think even the presence of the IV sometimes leads to inappropriate treatments too. So they get this unnecessary diagnosis, and then they get a shot of Rocephin, or they get an IV antibiotic for something that could have been treated easily with oral antibiotics. And then we see them a week later, they got Keflex orally, or they got Rocephin or something like that. And we see them a week later now with a yeast infection. Oh, and by the way, their urine culture is back and it was negative. And their source of pain is still untreated or undiagnosed. So that's a common thing I see. And again, it's not to disparage anybody, but not everybody has a UTI.
Yes. I think in emergency medicine, it seems like there's a tendency, more so than in other fields, to rely on testing to come up with a diagnosis. And this is probably inversely proportional to the quality of the history and physical exam that they're able to get. So if someone is a really confusing historian, they can't really describe very well what's going on with them, or maybe not allowing a full exam, then the doctors will have to get more testing to figure it out. But sometimes a whole panel of tests and imaging are ordered before the patient even has had any contact with the provider. As you've said, it's sometimes part of the setup of the workflow of a given ER. And then whatever result of that happens to come back positive is deemed to be possibly the reason for whatever symptoms are present. And I don't know that I necessarily see this right now where I practice, at least from what I've observed. I'd say there does tend to be more of a stepwise and judicial use of testing in general. But I know it's pretty common across the board, at least in the US and at least in maybe non-military settings. So anyway, let's move on to the next one, number four, which is bacterial vaginosis.
I don't know if people realize that you're an officer in the Navy.
Yeah.
But you don't make me call you ma'am or anything. So,
well, because you're a civilian, so.
Okay, what's number four, ma'am?
Bacterial vaginosis.
Yeah, a lot of BV is diagnosed. I think in the same way, the diagnoses, as you said, that have tests available for them are likely to be ordered, like that diagnosis is likely to be thought of. We, all physicians, like diagnoses that have a test that can tell them yes or no. Feels good. So a young woman gets a urinalysis and maybe a wet mount. She's got a complaint of some burning or discharge or whatever her complaint might be. And she gets gonorrhea and chlamydia testing because she's got a discharge or something. But what comes back immediately in the emergency department is the wet mount and says she has BV, which maybe she does. I will remind you that just seeing the presence of Gardnerella on a test, because there's all these molecular tests available now, that doesn't mean a person has bacterial vaginosis. And that's not the actual diagnostic criteria. So we already overdiagnose it anyway when we use molecular tests. But if she came to the emergency department, if her reason originally was significant abdominal pelvic pain, and now all she's leaving with is a prescription for Flagyl, and she's told that she has BV, she's almost certainly still going to be in pain when I see her for follow-up, because BV just doesn't cause severe pelvic pain. Even if she genuinely has it, that's not why she went to the ER with significant pelvic pain.
Yeah, about half of patients with BV are actually symptomatic. As an aside, that's one reason that it's been suggested to screen for BV before doing a hysterectomy, because there's so many people without symptoms that you can't just assume that they'll all come with the complaint beforehand. But anyway, back to this topic, we should point out that a significant percentage of women who have greater than 100,000 colony-forming units of bacteria in their urine are also asymptomatic, and we don't treat asymptomatic bacteriuria outside of pregnancy, so why would we treat asymptomatic BV? Again, outside of the context of getting a hysterectomy. I say that only because sometimes asymptomatic bacteriuria is discovered in the emergency department and still doesn't mean it's the cause of the symptoms, but it's definitely the case when a wet mount shows BV, unless her symptoms are related to vaginal discharge that's abnormal or vaginal irritation, then that finding is not the problem.
Yeah, we've actually harmed perhaps pregnant women by screening and treating for asymptomatic bacterial vaginosis in our quest to reduce the rates of preterm birth. And a lot of evidence has shown that the inflammation caused by the antibiotic actually did more harm than the BV itself did. So we can't just do things because they make sense to us. We need clinical data. But the important thing here, I think, just process-wise, is to order tests after you've talked to the patient and determined what your pretest probability for different diagnoses on your differential is that you're considering. Tests only work as part of a clinical pathway where we first interrogate the patient with history and physical and lab review or history review, things like that, determine what her risks and pretest probability for a given disease is, and then pick a test that's helpful to make that diagnosis. So That's a lot of what I talk about in my book, as you mentioned. But when emergency departments just order all the tests all the time up front, they necessarily distort that process and that thinking. And the result is emergency departments are known to have the highest rate of misdiagnosis of any specialty in medicine, despite spending the most money on tests to make that diagnosis. So that's just a systemic problem. It's, again, they've got to just change that pathway, I think, to fix that problem.
Yeah. Some of the same literature that talks about urinary tract infections being overdiagnosed in the ER also talk about sexually transmitted infections being underdiagnosed because you don't get those results back right away. So the patient who had pelvic pain and had BV, in fact, might actually have pelvic inflammatory disease or undiagnosed gonorrhea or chlamydia. And since there's no point of care tests available for either of those conditions, then they can go undiagnosed and they tend to. But that being said, I think most ER physicians are really good about covering for those infections empirically in a patient. And the additional treatment of BV may just be in someone that they already decided to treat empirically for PID as well. And at least personally, I see a lot of presumptive PID diagnoses in patients who later we determine actually have chronic pain for some other reason. So I maybe even see it overdiagnosed, but that's, I don't know, is it might be better in this case than underdiagnosing PID.
I think it is, especially since it can lead to peritonitis, infertility, serious. Yeah. So we do, this is a case where we want to overdiagnose and overtreat a little bit. And I think that we could have a philosophical debate about how much is too much. But yeah, they should be overtreating. Okay, well, that's a good segue to number five, which is related to that, and that is cervical motion tenderness just isn't what you think it is. So a lot of patients, as you mentioned, are treated empirically for PID in the emergency department, and sometimes that's based purely upon the presence of cervical motion tenderness on a pelvic exam. We were all taught in medical school about chandelier signs and cervical motion tenderness. I think everybody's had that drilled into them. But it's inaccurate. So cervical motion tenderness only has a positive likelihood ratio of 1.1 for the diagnosis of pelvic inflammatory disease. So if you don't use likelihood ratios routinely, we should talk about that. But likelihood ratios are just modify the your pre-test odds of a person having a condition. And so when you do a test or a physical exam, you can use a positive or negative likelihood ratio to change your odds based upon the result, the positive or negative result of that exam. So 1.1 or is just not a great test. That means realistically, if you thought that a patient had a 15% pretest probability of pelvic inflammatory disease before you did the exam and it came and then you decided she had it, then your post-test probability after that finding would be 16%.
So 15% versus 16%, that's basically not different at all.
Yeah, exactly. So would you change your treatment? I was going to wait till 16% threshold to decide to treat or not 15%. It doesn't change your management, which means that you're not supposed to actually do an exam for cervical motion tenderness, which I think is shocking to some people to realize. And it shouldn't play any role at all in your decision to treat a patient for pelvic inflammatory disease. That should not be related to your thought process. And cervical motion tenderness isn't just a case of a woman who's uncomfortable with having a bimanual exam. And this is where the test also is overinterpreted. I think women who go to the ED with pelvic or abdominal pain and then receive a bimanual exam by someone who frankly doesn't do them for a living, doesn't do multiple ones a day, they will complain of discomfort or pain with the exam. Just putting your hand on their abdomen, if they went there for abdominal or pelvic pain, is likely to elicit a complaint of significant pain, but that doesn't mean that they have cervical motion tenderness.
Yeah, or if they have maybe unrelatedly pelvic floor pain, then I wonder how many ER providers are going to be able to distinguish the pain from inserting the speculum or inserting their gloved hand versus pain from manipulating the cervix. If they already have significant pain just from insertion from maybe a muscle spasm, then that could easily get interpreted as cervical motion tenderness. So the likelihood ratio for even a true cervical motion tenderness, which probably a lot of times is not true, is still only 1.1. But
yeah, and the negative likelihood ratio. So you might say, okay, well, I'll use it to rule it out. So what if I go and she doesn't have cervical motion tenderness, then that should give me some reassurance. But the negative likelihood ratio is only 0.9. So you can do the math and see it's the same way. If it was a 15% pretest and she doesn't have it at all, it's only like 14% post-test. So it just doesn't mean anything positive or negative.
Interesting. So the true cervical motion tenderness is when it's specifically the cervix and it's just a very subtle movement, not like cranking it around or anything, but just tiny movement causes a huge amount of pain.
Yeah, subtle movement, extreme pain. But in any event, the exam just shouldn't be done when you're evaluating a patient for PID because it doesn't have clinical value in terms of increasing or decreasing your thought process about that diagnosis. We don't need to be overly reliant on bad tests, whether those are physical exams or lab tests for that matter. This is like a Holman sign for DVT. I think you and I probably learned Holman sign in med school. Mm-hmm. I certainly did. Maybe they stopped teaching it when you were there. You're so young. But it's such a bad test that you shouldn't do it because it leads you to either overdiagnosis or a false sense of confidence that the patient doesn't have a DVT. Don't do Holman signs. Don't do cervical motion tenderness exams.
All right. Well, number six is IUDs. So they don't cause PID. They don't cause BV or UTIs, or really, they don't tend to cause pain. And they actually don't need to be removed just because imaging says that they're in the improper position.
Yeah, this is a huge one for us. And of course, we've talked about it's getting worse in the age of TikTok defaming birth control in general and IUDs in particular. But there are just a lot of, I think, cultural misconceptions about IUDs out there. And physicians of all specialties are certainly not immune to these beliefs, including OBGYNs. I hear a lot of nonsense from OBGYNs about how IUDs work and what they do and things like that. So let's go through those ideas one at a time. So you mentioned pelvic inflammatory disease. And actually, I can deal with that one by doing the historical tidbit too for this explanation, because you kind of have to know how we got the PID connection to understand why it's not true. But the history of the intrauterine device actually goes back to 1928, at least 1928, to depending on how you define an IUD, to Dr. Ernst Grafenberg. And there was a lot of development over the next 30 years. He had a very simple device. And anyway, by the 70s, there was an IUD on the market called the Dalcon Shield. And this was invented in 1968 by a doctor named Hugh Davis and a friend of his who was an engineer named Erwin Lerner. And it became a very, very popular contraceptive in the early 1970s. And in just two or three years, really, it got to the point where there were 2.8 million women in the U.S. who had one. So just very rapid adoption and expansion. And I'll say that anytime something comes out that's a rager like that, attorneys line up to sue the company that made it. That's still true today. You'll see commercials for Ozempic all over TV now just because Ozempic is selling out like Blockbuster. So that's just the same thing happened to the Dalcon Shield. Now, put this all in context, this was at a time when the other major choice of birth control was the pill. And the pill was also on a rapid incline in terms of use. And the pill in the early 1970s still contained significantly more estrogen than modern pills do, which means that a lot of women were suffering from DVTs and pulmonary embolisms related to those higher doses of estrogens. And those stories were all over the media. The second a woman dies because she took the pill from a pulmonary embolism, you can imagine that people would have a variety of reasons to spring on that. And like just like people do with COVID-19 stories or things like that, this was happening with the pill. So that particular problem, of course, got a lot better over the years because we've worked to continually lower the dose of estrogen in the pill. But people were concerned about the safety profile of birth control pills. And in that context, this new IUD just took off. It doesn't have hormones in it. It doesn't have estrogen in it. In fact, there was a series of congressional hearings called the Nelson hearings by Senator Gaylord Nelson in 1970, which had their motivations, and you can imagine what they were. But they were investigating the efficacy and safety profile of the birth control pill. And this actually gave a platform to Dr. Davis, the guy that invented the Dalcon Shield. He went and testified at the hearings and was selling the pill as this dangerous thing. And that led to great marketing opportunities for the alternative he was ready to provide women and the financial success of the Dalcon Shield. Well, fast forward in 1973, the CDC did a study. And again, we could spend an hour talking about this study. They concluded that 5 women out of every 1,000 IUD users ended up requiring hospitalization, and they found 5 reports of fatalities that they directly attributed to the IUD. One of these was associated with the Dalcon Shield. The other 4 were actually not the Dalcon Shield, but they were mostly related to severe infections. Now, again, that study is a hugely problematic and flawed study. They had a very small data set that they just assumed applied to the whole country and almost certainly didn't, things like that. But that's another story. But by 1974, the Dalkon shield makers were already then fending off allegations that there were more septic abortions with the device, more cases of severe pelvic inflammatory disease. And before long, there were over 200,000 women joined a class action lawsuit claiming that the device had caused them to have PID and then subsequent loss of fertility or hysterectomy or worse. And so eventually they went bankrupt. All told, there were 327,000 lawsuits filed, and women claimed every kind of thing, PID, ectopic pregnancies, perforations. It cost the company billions. And in 1976, this did lead the FDA to take control over medical devices. This is actually why they did this, and to require safety and testing approval like they do for drugs, but for medical devices. But the big claim about the Dalkon shield, the big claim of negligence that affected it versus other IEDs, was that it was poorly designed because it had a multifilament string that allowed wicking of bacteria from the vagina, and that could be normal flora, it could be chlamydia, whatever it was, that would wick the bacteria up into the uterus, and if it was the right pathogen, could cause severe sepsis, PID, Asherman syndrome, whatever it was, or even death. And that's the reason, by the way, why all modern IEDs use monofilament strings. And all this was a public relations fiasco, and all the advertising that lawyers did to find women to bring into the class because they wanted to sue and all that, it created a whole generation of people who believed that IEDs were the devil. But the reality is the Dalkon shield and other IEDs in the 1970s, which were similar in design, they didn't actually do those things. They didn't increase the risks. The multifilament string didn't tend to wick more bacteria up into the vagina. So analysis later done in the 1980s by epidemiologists found really serious flaws in the methodologies that were used by the attorneys to make these claims. And I think that at this point, it would be a fair statement to say that legitimate scientists no longer believe that the Dalkon shield was really a problem at all. And in any event, it was way safer, as he claimed, than the birth control pill in terms of overall mortality risk due to the thromboembolism issue. But the damage was done, and here we are. Everybody remembers some form of that still today.
Yeah, then took a long time for IUDs to come back to the market in America after all of that with the Dalkon shield. Most IUDs of that time were just inert pieces of plastic. No substances or medications coming off of them, except for the copper IUDs, which we still have around. But all of those inert plastic IUDs went away. So far, they went away permanently in the US. But it was actually a Finnish doctor named Jouni Valter Tapani-Luukkainen who created the original progesterone-eluting IUD in 1976 called Progestisert. He was born in Sortavala in Finland, and he directed the steroid research laboratory at the University of Helsinki. This device never really took off because it was only good for a year, but eventually it morphed into the five-year Mirena IUD, which was created by that same physician in the 80s, which did take off, as we know. But it didn't come to the US until 2001, largely because there was such bad public perception of IUDs from the Dalkon shield. We talked before that Europeans and Asians are a lot more comfortable with IUDs than Americans are, and that's probably still largely due to the hangover of the misunderstood Dalkon shield controversy. And I'm pretty sure I didn't learn about IUDs. I had no idea what they were or that they existed until after college. I graduated in 2009. So I think they still, even when they came to the US in 2001, it took them a while to become mainstream. And I still remember I went to ask for one from a gynecologist when I was just graduated, newly married, applying for med school. And that gynecologist told me that my uterus was too small because I hadn't had a baby yet. So no IUD for me. She put me on a pill instead, and it turned out to be a pill that I didn't really like. So I would have really liked to have that IUD back then. But now we've obviously come a long way since then. We put them in nulliparous patients all the time. But that's another tangent from our talk.
Well, it's important, though. The labeling that when the Mirena did come out in 2001, the labeling had all of these exclusions in it. Now, some of that's been taken away over the years, but it was all a hangover from that lawsuit. It wasn't the scientists that put that labeling in there. It wasn't the FDA. It was the attorneys. And so if you read the product insert label, it basically said only put it in married women with kids. And that was why? Because married women don't get gonorrhea and chlamydia, And when people with kids don't get perfed or something like that, those things just aren't true. And so that was still part of the original labeling. And then a lot of people, when they were coming out, they were marketed by product reps. And, well, we don't really recommend this for women who've not had children before or women who are at increased risk for pelvic inflammatory disease, like unmarried college girls. And so it's taken a long time to get past all that. So, and we're not past it, frankly. Look at TikTok. But in any event, modern hormone-eluting IUDs do actually decrease the risk of pelvic inflammatory disease due to the thickening of the cervical mucus, which makes it harder for bacteria to ascend up into the uterus. Now, if you have chlamydia at the moment that I insert it, then that will tend to increase your risk. This is why we think about whether a woman might have gonorrhea, chlamydia, particularly for women under 25, before we insert it. But once it's inserted, because it thickens the cervical mucus, it actually decreases it. The risk. And the presence of an IUD doesn't increase your risk for BV or urinary tract infections or other vaginitis type complaints. They don't normally cause pain or anything like that. Now, they can sometimes cause pain with orgasm or maybe worse and more painful periods if they're partially embedded. So those complaints should be taken seriously. But the key feature is that such pain would be present really just with orgasm or with menstrual cramps. When the uterus is cramping, that's when they would tend to notice increased pain.
Yeah, and a lot of women will go to the ER and then be told that the IUD is maybe low in the uterus or turned sideways or something like that. And that just doesn't matter. At least with the hormone-eluting one, if it's low, it doesn't matter. It still works. That may not be quite as true for the copper IUD, but certainly for the Mirena. They work just as well. They should be left alone. Although I'd say if they are found to be partially embedded and there is pain that's bothersome that happens with uterine cramps, like during menses, I probably would still offer to remove the device if that's what the patient wants.
Yeah, unfortunately, we see patients all the time come in, again, due to misperceptions, and they're convinced it's caused their weight gain, their headaches, their whatever. And if they want it out, you have to take it out. I still tell them, high quality data says this isn't the cause of your headaches, but let's take it out. And they come back sometimes, you know, 2 months later. Yeah, you're right. Give it back to me. But they need to prove that to themselves sometimes. So there was a study a few years ago that actually looked at this specific course. So if it's low placed, turned the wrong way, cervical, are you better off taking it out or leaving it in terms of pregnancies? And they found way more pregnancies if you took it out, which just makes sense because then women switch to a less effective method of birth control because they think that IUDs aren't good for them. And so the recommendation was just to leave them. I've seen some ER docs who will take them out in the ER. Most don't. They'll send for follow-up, which would be appreciated. Maybe the patient demanded it, though. They're just convinced it's their problem. But I've also seen some folks who seem to have the perception that if they're turned the wrong way, like if the arms of the T are not kissing the ostia of the fallopian tubes and it doesn't work, as if it's some sort of mechanical block or something. Just, I don't know. But if they're turned sideways, it doesn't matter. The patient doesn't have symptoms related to it. Leave it alone.
Yep. All right, let's do number 7, and that's HCG levels. So these are not useful in pregnancies after about 6 weeks, unless you cannot locate the pregnancy on ultrasound, of course. So a lot of women will go to the emergency department with an early pregnancy. Maybe it's something related to that, like spotting or cramping, and then the docs will check an HCG level. But if they already have a viable intrauterine pregnancy, then that level is absolutely meaningless, just completely. And I see this often enough where there's a baby, there's a heartbeat, and still there's a blood HCG level. Why? I don't know. They definitely do not need to follow it up in 2 days with a repeat HCG to see if it doubles or falls or anything like that. Really, if it's past 5 weeks and 5 days, and you can confirm it by ultrasound, the only thing that matters is the ultrasound. And also, HCGs don't double every 48 hours forever in a pregnancy. If they did, then eventually people would have levels in the billions, and they don't.
Simple math. Yeah, and in fact, they start to level off or even go down over the course of a normal pregnancy. And I've seen patients scared by this because they have this expectation that they should be doubling constantly. So yeah, as you said, quantitative HCGs are only valuable early in a pregnancy when the ultrasound isn't revealing. You can't see the location or what's going on. So there's a lot to this one, including the concept of the discriminatory threshold of when you should expect to see whatever you should be able to see on ultrasound and when that occurs, things like that. But if a pregnant woman comes to the ED and has, as you said, an established pregnancy, and she believes she's more than 6 weeks, then an HCG is just as unnecessary if you can see that on ultrasound. It also, sometimes ERs, I think, get the quant because they don't have ultrasound available at night. So they want to do something to reassure the patient, but it's just not reassuring. It just doesn't mean anything. It may come back declined compared to a previous value. And if anything, you've scared them for no reason, but that's what they do. I'll put a link to one of my favorite Howardisms that describes, has some good graphs on how to use HCG tests appropriately and what they look like throughout pregnancy. And I'll also say that you can't date a pregnancy by an HCG. I see this one a lot too, where the lab assay will have a range, 1 to 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, whatever. There's a lot of overlap in that. So you can't just tell a patient because her HCG is 18,000 that she's so many weeks. But I see that done way too often as well.
Interesting. That's one I haven't seen, but I can see how that would lead to a lot of confusion. Anyway, yeah, that Howardisms article is a good one for sure. So people should look at that. So let's do number 8, CT scans in pregnant women. They can receive them if it's necessary. It does kind of seem like when a woman goes to the emergency department and is pregnant, that everyone is afraid of every single possible intervention. And they're often treated differently when they show up because the assumption is that they can't have any imaging tests outside of an ultrasound. And for that matter, they can't have any medications or really anything. But a pregnant woman who has a potential serious illness, like let's say appendicitis or mesenteric ischemia or whatever illness is something that an ER doctor normally would do a CT scan for in a non-pregnant patient, they should do that same scan for the pregnant one. They shouldn't treat that any differently if it's a serious disease.
Yeah, the fear of radiation exposure in pregnancy is really extraordinary and largely unfounded. I think we've talked about this before. I can't remember, but pregnant women who need imaging can be imaged. The amount of radiation exposure that we're concerned about being deleterious for developing pregnancy is not different than the amount of radiation exposure we're concerned about being deleterious for anybody. I'll put a couple of links to CDC information website about this and some interesting stuff from a physics association that does a Q&A on all sorts of radiation exposure during pregnancy, including like cell phone and power lines and things like that, that I thought was interesting. But the bottom line for imaging is that there's not a given single diagnostic test that you can order in a hospital that a pregnant woman who needs it shouldn't receive.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a different conversation about whether a woman should receive a CT if there's suspicion for appendicitis in pregnancy versus whether she should receive an MRI. The MRI is simply better than the CT scan in identifying appendicitis in pregnancy. It's not really as much about the radiation exposure as it is about the accuracy of diagnosis. The MRI is just better in pregnancy for the appendix. But MRI, of course, it's not always available at odd hours and in the middle of the night and things like that at many hospitals. So sometimes we do still need to at least try to use a CT scan to see if we can see it or if we can identify some other acute abdominal process in a pregnant patient.
Yeah, and I don't think it's any big secret that ERs overutilize CT scan for just generic run you through there. It's almost a cliche. But I would encourage ER providers to have the same thoughtfulness for non-pregnant people whom they might order a CT for as they do for pregnant people who might need a CT. The bottom line is, if a CT scan is necessary, a pregnant woman can have it. And certainly x-rays and other things like that are not even in the realm of possible concern. You can get thousands of chest x-rays while pregnant before you get to a concerning level of radiation. My point being, though, that we should be concerned about radiation exposure in everyone. I once saw a lady who had pelvic pain, had been going around to various ERs, and it turned out in the last year, this younger woman had had something between 30 and 40 CT scans in emergency departments, just every week or whatever. So she wasn't pregnant, but yeah, like don't order any test that's unnecessary, but when it's necessary, it's safe. I'm also glad you mentioned MRIs. I also once had a radiologist refuse to do the MRI on a pregnant woman with a brain tumor. And I remember calling him and asking what his concern was. And he mentioned that there was no safety data about the radiation from MRIs in pregnant women. And I think I asked him what residency he went to or something like that. And no, he wasn't talking about the contrast media. This was a non-contrasted MRI. So I think people just kind of get like stupid around pregnant women.
Sometimes, yeah, it does seem that way. That's a very cringeworthy story for that radiologist. Hopefully they've learned.
We had an educational the session.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's move on to number 9. Women who are pregnant or who have recently delivered or recently been pregnant and who present with shortness of breath at night or shortness of breath with walking or dry cough or tachycardia and chest pain or significant swelling and fatigue, which is a big collection of some not very common and not specific symptoms, those women need to be evaluated for peripartum cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, a significant number. We could do a whole show on when to take symptoms like that seriously and when, like, it's a tough thing. But a significant number of maternal deaths in the United States are due to peripartum cardiomyopathy, particularly of those that we think are preventable. And this disproportionately affects women of color who are at an increased risk for having peripartum cardiomyopathy and perhaps at an increased risk of having that go undiagnosed. So when we look at individual cases, we find that these women have often gone to the emergency department often more than once, some cases numerous times, with complaints like the ones you listed, and no one thought about it. No, they received no evaluation for cardiomyopathy, and then at some point they rapidly declined and in many cases died.
We don't know exactly why this condition happens. There's a bunch of theories, but the incidence is about 1 in 1,000 live births, and it's more likely to occur in older patients. Of course, it can occur in all ages, but more likely in older patients, and the incidence is highest among Black women living in the southern United States. And actually, among Nigerian women, the incidence is close to 1 in 100. So nearly 3/4 of patients who have this happen have had 3 or more pregnancies already, usually without any prior concern for this condition. It's more common among women who are carrying or who just had multiples, like twins or more. And it's also more common among poor women, and especially more common among women with pre-existing hypertension, because they already have some cardiac dysfunction, most likely.
And the evaluation can be confusing because a lot of just normal pregnancy findings might be present in these women. That's the tough part of our job sometimes, or at least the findings might be thought to be related to normal physiologic changes. We tend to dismiss a lot of shortness of breath and things like that. The EKG will show sinus tachycardia and some other non-specific changes, not really helpful. The X-ray may show an enlarged cardiac silhouette, not super helpful either, but depending on the size, or more specifically, pleural effusions. And of course, this means that you need to get a chest X-ray on a pregnant woman who's got some of these complaints and not be afraid of the radiation. But ultimately, an echocardiogram is what's needed for the diagnosis. And so the mistake here is not ordering the echo.
And early detection with the echo is critical to improve outcomes. So we'll put a link to a review of peripartum cardiomyopathy for anyone who wants to brush up.
Okay, and then our last one that we have for today, number 10, is that a lot of lab parameters are usually based upon 200-pound white men, not pregnant women.
Yes, a lot of labs will vary significantly during pregnancy from that 200-pound white man reference range. And so they'll be listed out as abnormal when in fact they may be normal for pregnant women. So the very obvious examples are hemoglobin and hematocrit, which will be lower than that reference range and will result as abnormal, even though in pregnancy this occurs due to physiologic dilution of hemoglobin. So really anything above 10.5 hemoglobin is probably normal in pregnancy, but it'll still show up as red highlighted abnormal on your lab results. And also the white blood cell count goes up during pregnancy. So it shouldn't be super concerning to see white counts of 15 or 16 or even 17, as long as there's no left shift or neutrophil predominance, which that would indicate an acute infection.
Yet another one is serum creatinine. So there's an increase in the glomerular filtration rate while you're pregnant. And so this will have the effect of making the serum creatinine lower. And ironically, a pregnant woman with acute kidney injury may actually have a normal creatinine in the normal lab value range, but it's actually significantly elevated for a pregnant woman. A woman can have a 50%+ elevation of her serum creatinine and still appear well in that normal range. So there's also a decrease typically in albumin, and that you may see that as an abnormal on labs as well.
And during the first trimester, TSH may be transiently low simply due to the high levels of HCG. That will ultimately level off and then the TSH will recover. But if you just look at that red value, you might think, oh, wow, she's hyperthyroid and we didn't even know it before she got pregnant. In the third trimester, D-dimers will be elevated above reference range in about 90% of pregnant women. So in almost all cases, it would be probably inappropriate to order a D-dimer on a pregnant woman unless you're planning to use some kind of pregnancy-specific algorithm for looking at those results.
And in the same way, beta-type natriuretic peptide, BNP, will be increased in pregnant women compared to non-pregnant women, but that level still will remain within the normal range. So a BNP can still be quite useful for diagnosing and screening for heart failure during pregnancy, but it will definitely be at the higher end of the range. And that's okay, because as we just mentioned, though, we should have a relatively low threshold for ordering echocardiogram in some of these patients. So that's okay.
Just in summary of that, if a BNP flags as abnormal, you should still consider it abnormal.
That's right.
In contrast to all these other examples where different things flag abnormal and they're fine. But
yeah, well, like with the creatinine, a normal creatinine could indicate a problem. But I mentioned that one just because somebody may have heard, and they're right, that BNP will be higher during pregnancy, but you can still use that as a test.
Okay. Well, we still have a minute, I think, to talk about a couple quick news items. So firstly, what do you think about over-the-counter birth control? Because it seems like that's coming up soon.
Yeah, this FDA advisory panel voted actually unanimously to make a pill called Opill, O-P-I-L-L, over-the-counter. I'm not sure about the name. But this is a progestin-only birth control pill. So I do not personally believe that this is a good idea. And remember, this FDA panel, their job is only to address whether or not it's safe for a company who wants to market a pill over the counter. Their job is not to decide whether or not it's a smart idea or not. And people are confused by that. FDA approval doesn't mean that we should all use something or that it's a great thing. And in this case, drugs go over the counter by application if you can show a good track record of safety. And I think that it is safe. It's safe to have a progestin-only pill over the counter. There's no estrogen in it. And therefore, there's really just very few real contraindications or safety concerns, and they're very rare contraindications. So it's not a safety issue. But the unintended consequence is that we're taking one of the single worst forms of birth control in terms of its efficacy, and one of the hardest to be fully compliant with in terms of when you need to take it and things like that to even get what crappy efficacy it has. And we're making it over the counter in a country where women already don't know the true failure rates of birth control pills and things like that. So the failure rate in the unintended pregnancies related to this will be significant. So this is just the mini pill. I would rather a patient come to me and discuss birth control because she's very likely to leave with a long-acting reversible contraceptive after we've had a conversation. And frankly, I haven't prescribed a mini pill for birth control in many, many, many years. There's really not a reason to do that. And a fully informed, educated woman, I don't think, would take the mini pill when she had other alternatives presented to her. So it's just not a good choice of contraception. Is it safe? Yeah. But it's not safe in the sense that this will lead to a false sense of security and a lot of unintended pregnancies. And I don't know about pricing. I wonder about that. And I hope that issue, meaning that it's expensive, will lead women to still go and discuss birth control with their physician and get something paid for by insurance and maybe something more effective. So I don't know. Ironically, the panel specifically discussed that people with limited literacy in adolescence would likely benefit from this, which is just absurd to me. It's not based upon any science. And the data actually shows that giving this sort of pill to an adolescent population increases the pregnancy rate. They're better off without access because then they use condoms and they don't take chances. So the pregnancy rate actually goes up among adolescents who are given this sort of pill. So I think the whole thing's misguided, and you can tell me I'm wrong.
Okay, well, in principle, I agree. Most people probably don't realize just how failure-prone this form of birth control is, at least not if their provider isn't there to emphasize that to them. And it's also not good at all at regulating menstrual bleeding. But my counterpoint is that in practice, I could see how a lot of people out there might truly not have good access to appropriate contraceptive counseling and care. And although there are already websites out there that can remotely take a history and have a prescriber review for any contraindications and then mail them a prescription, I suppose another barrier, maybe like an artificial barrier, might be shame. Like maybe the patients still think they're going to end up with a pelvic exam, or for some reason they don't want to mess with going to the doctor, even if they do have access. There's probably a lot of different hypotheticals here. But for those people, I think getting this is probably better than nothing, even though it's still worse than anything else, probably worse than condoms, honestly. But I think in the long run, this could be positive in that it could be maybe a gateway for getting combined hormonal contraception over the counter, which is a lot more effective.
But also has more contraindications.
True.
And honestly, the pharmacist may do, I'm assuming this is going to be behind the counter, but maybe not. I don't know what the requirements would be. But, you know, if they were required by the FDA to do a safety checklist and the patient signed a thing saying, I understand the failure rate and that there's other alternatives, they might actually be getting better education about it. And I've seen the idea with combined OCPs about being behind the counter and what that list would be like. And I guarantee the pharmacist would probably do a better job of rooting out contraindications and telling people the risks and of the medicine than doctors often do with it. So pros and cons. Over-the-counter birth control is common in a lot of European countries like France. But the thing about French women is they don't use them because they all want to go get IUDs. So that's what's always bothered me a little bit. Culturally, in those countries, women go get IUDs, and over-the-counter birth control pills are a rare thing, like Plan B's over-the-counter. It's there, but it's not something that they're just going every month and buying for their main contraceptive very often.
Okay. Well, to be continued on that, we'll see how the FDA panel goes. One more quick hit. Maybe. What do you think about the draft of the new mammogram guidelines that the USPSTF has said, where they propose starting screening at age 40 and to do it every 2 years, as opposed to the current recommendation to start at age 50?
I'm okay with this, which probably surprises a lot of students and residents that know me, but I'm okay with this. This is a margin call, and this is an area of a lot of debate, and one data set pushes back one way or the other. There is new data involved in this decision. And some of this reflects 3D mammogram being integrated in, things like that. But the important thing about mammography in the 40s that the American Cancer Society and the current U.S. Preventive Task Force Service guideline represents is that it shouldn't occur every year. There's just no scientific reason at all for a low to average risk woman to get a yearly mammogram in the 40s. And that's what seems to happen all the time. The 10 successive years of radiation is associated with one woman per thousand dying of an extra cancer due to that radiation exposure, as well as a lot of false positive workups, biopsies, near misses, things like that. And some women being diagnosed with cancer who didn't have it. A mammogram exposes a woman to up to 20 x-rays worth of radiation, so that's 0.4 millisieverts compared to 0.02 for a PA and lateral x-ray. It's also associated with overdiagnosis of breast cancer, as I said, in that same 1,000 women, 4 or 5 women will be overdiagnosed with breast cancer and receive treatment that they didn't need and didn't benefit from. So we've all been trying to figure out where the best benefit risk ratio is and how to prevent the one woman per 1,000 in her 40s of dying of a breast cancer, which mammography in the 40s does do, while at the same time not killing a woman with excess radiation exposure. And cutting the amount of radiation exposure in half is a way of doing that. And that's why the American Cancer Society actually says to start doing mammograms at age 45. So, and those are annuals for them, so that they only get 5 in their 40s rather than 10. So this is a similar approach of cutting the amount of radiation in half, but it recognizes too that there has been an increased rate of breast cancer, particularly of women in color in their 40s and throughout their 40s, not just in the latter half of the decade. So let's do one every other year, hopefully save the one woman per 1,000 who benefits from mammography without killing a woman per 1,000 from excess radiation exposure. I'm not going to grandstand over this, and I think they'll change again every few years, and that's okay as we learn more about how to do this. I think in a different time, we might have a more risk-based strategy, but a lot of guidelines, the colorectal screening guidelines, are getting away from race-based categories. That's one of the big reasons why colonoscopy's gone to age 45 instead of 50, where that recommendation used to be race-based. And some of that's represented in this too. But overall, I'm okay with it.
Well, I guess this new recommendation makes me a lot closer to my first screening mammogram. I guess that's another milestone to look forward to in the near future. But anyway, we hope you enjoyed this episode. And if there's any ER or primary care docs or urgent care folks out there who maybe have pet peeves about OBGYNs or things that you wish we would better understand about what you do, then we'd love to hear from you. But otherwise, we'll be back in a couple of weeks and maybe, hopefully, with one of our returning guest stars. We'll see.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.